All right, hello everyone. We will get the webinar started momentarily here. If I could get a confirmation in the chat box that our participants can hear me, please indicate as much. You should note that I cannot hear you. You're all in lecture mode. Great. Okay, I see that I am audible. That's a great start. So welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today. We are going to explore the world of compensatory mitigation today, and it's a very dynamic and interesting program and can be a potential resource for a lot of the restoration projects that we're working on throughout the Colorado River Basin. And so I'm excited about our lineup of experts and practitioners that we have on the phone today. And before we get started, I'm just going to do a quick introduction about the webinar here and provide you with some ground rules. You will note, as I mentioned, that all the participants are muted, and therefore we are going to take all of the questions after each of the presentations have been concluded. So it will be at the very end of the webinar that we'll have questions. And if you want to ask questions, you need to be on the phone, not just on the computer. So the flyer that was sent out has instructions both to log on to the website and call in as well. And so if you want to ask questions at the tail end of all of the presentations, then you'll need to be on the phone. We suggest that you take notes throughout the different presentations so that you can keep track of who you have questions for. That's that can be an easier way of kind of tracking who you want to ask what. We also ask that you take the time to enter your name and your organization or watershed into the chat box on the left there. That will serve as our sign-in sheet and gives our presenters a sense for who is on the call. It's advisable that you mute your computers to prevent feedback if you're on the phone as well, because obviously if you're hearing from two different sources, it can be confusing. When you're asking your questions, we'll ask that you mention your name and your affiliation, and at the tail end of the webinar, we will have everyone fill out a survey. And I will send that link out towards the end of the webinar. Just a little bit about the Tamarisk Coalition, if you're not familiar with our organization. We are a small nonprofit based in Grand Junction, but we work throughout the southwestern U.S. to advance the restoration of riparian lands through collaboration, education, and technical assistance. And we do this in a number of different ways. We work with a wide array of partnerships that are multi-stakeholder groups that are doing on-the-ground implementation. We help them develop plans and provide capacity and research, best management practices, and also information about funding, which this webinar series is a component of. So you're participating in one of our programs to try and share more information about the different types of funding resources that are out there for accomplishing restoration work. We also host conferences. We are hosting a conference in February of 2014 on the 14th and 15th, I believe. I'll have to double check that. And that will be a conference focused on research and land management practices. We also have a biological control monitoring program and many other resources. And I encourage you to visit our website at www.tamariskcoalition.org for more information. About a little bit about the funding webinar series, we have a couple webinars coming up in addition to this one. We have one that's going to be focused on landscape conservation cooperatives, and that will be on December 18th, also at noon Mountain Standard Time. And then we have a webinar scheduled for January 17th, which is going to focus on voluntary surcharge programs. So if you're interested in learning more about these, you can feel free to email me or to look online when closer to those dates, and I can send you those resources. But also, if you have ideas for funding webinars that relate to riparian restoration work, please feel free to send those to me as well. All right. I'm going to pull up our first presentation here momentarily and introduce our presenter, and then we'll kick this off. Just a moment. Our first presenter is Stephen Martin. He is an environmental planner with the Army Corps of Engineers Institute for Water Resources. His work focuses on compensatory mitigation policy and includes national implementation of the regulatory in-lieu fee and bank information tracking system, also known as RIBITS. And he teaches compensatory mitigation policy and provides developmental tools to assist regulators in improving compensatory mitigation. And I've heard from multiple sources that he is a great resource for better understanding this program. So I'm going to ask Stephen to unmute himself and kick us off.
Okay. Thank you very much, Kristen.
Thank you.
As she indicated, I'm going to give you a down and dirty overview of compensatory mitigation, that is, compensation to offset permitted impacts to aquatic resources under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. So here you've got the basic overall objective of the Clean Water Act, to restore and maintain chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the nation's waters. One small portion of that is Section 404. Congress gave the Corps of Engineers the authority to regulate discharge of dredge or placement of fill material into waters of the U.S. Under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. Our responsibility then is essentially to protect the nation's aquatic resources while allowing reasonable development. This is basically then a balancing act. On the one hand, we're charged with authorizing activities under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act and Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act. On the other hand, we have to balance that with other federal mandates, such as the Endangered Species Act, National Environmental Policy Act, National Historic Preservation Act, and so on. The Section 404 program is guided by the goal of achieving no net loss or no overall net loss of wetland acreage and functions. We're charged with only permitting the least environmentally damaging practicable project alternative. And before we can actually issue a permit, we have to follow a three-part mitigation sequence. Basically, then, what we're looking at is, first, any proposed losses have to be avoided to the maximum extent practicable, then any remaining losses minimized to the extent appropriate and practicable, and then finally, appropriate and practicable compensatory mitigation is required for the remaining unavoidable adverse impacts. And this compensatory mitigation, this offset for the unavoidable impacts, is what we refer to in a shorthand way as mitigation. Now, you need to understand that compensatory mitigation may not be required for all permit actions. Many actions may not actually result in a loss of waters or aquatic resource functions, or they may only have a temporary or a minimal impact on waters. Or it may very well be the decision is that compensatory mitigation for a given project is neither appropriate nor practicable. Now, currently, the where, the how compensatory mitigation is done, is undertaken under Section 404 is specified in joint regulations issued by the Corps and the Environmental Protection Agency in 2008. It's often referred to as the mitigation rule. It governs all forms of compensatory mitigation, whether we're talking wetlands, streams, coral reefs, and all providers of mechanism, whether we're talking project-specific compensatory mitigation, mitigation banks, in-lieu fee programs, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. And it requires that all of those forms of mitigation, banking, in-lieu fee, or project-specific, be held to equivalent standards. It does, however, express a preference for third-party mitigation, mitigation banks, and in-lieu fee programs. And I'll talk about that in just a couple of moments. Our overall concern is that the compensatory mitigation that we approve offsets environmental losses, that's lost functions and services, resulting from the unavoidable impacts to waters authorized by our permits. So in reviewing a project and compensatory mitigation, in reviewing a mitigation proposal, we have to determine what that compensation is based on what is practicable and what will actually offset the aquatic resource functions that are going to be lost. So when we're evaluating those options, we have to consider what would be environmentally preferable. We have to assess the likelihood for ecological success and sustainability, the location of the compensation site relative to the impact site, and the significance of both within the watershed or landscape, and also consider the costs of the compensatory mitigation project. Now, there's basically four methods of providing compensatory mitigation. That would be restoration of aquatic resources, enhancement, establishment, also known as creation, putting an aquatic resource where it didn't previously occur, and preservation. And the compensatory mitigation requirements have to be commensurate with the amount and type of impact that is associated with a particular core permit. And this is consistent with a number of court decisions and the holdings of those decisions. Now, our regs also speak to the type of compensatory mitigation. In-kind compensation is generally preferred. By in-kind, we mean the same aquatic resource type, so that if you're looking at, say, impacts to an intermittent stream, generally restoration or rehabilitation of an intermittent stream would be appropriate compensatory mitigation. Providing wetlands to offset that impact might not be appropriate. The preference for in-kind is based on this idea of replacing lost aquatic resource functions, and it's generally thought that in-kind compensation is more likely to replace those lost functions than out-of-kind. Now, compensatory mitigation can either be on the impact site or off-site or a combination of both, and we frequently do see combinations of both to replace the range of aquatic resource functions that are lost. For instance, on-site compensation to replace perhaps water quality or flood storage functions, and off-site to replace habitat. Now, there are resources that are considered difficult to replace, aquatic resources that, frankly, we don't have the scientific knowledge or the technical know-how to actually replace. We're talking systems like bogs, fens, streams, here in the east, perhaps Atlantic white cedar swamps. In that kind of scenario, the mitigation rule indicates that once impacts have been avoided to the extent practicable and you're looking at compensatory mitigation, that compensation would take the form either of rehabilitation of existing degraded resources, enhancement of resources, or preservation. Now, compensation, compensatory mitigation, to the maximum extent practicable, has to be initiated before or concurrent with the project impacts to minimize temporal loss. And while we're to require an amount of mitigation sufficient to replace lost functions. If we don't have some sort of a functional assessment, then typically a minimum one-to-one replacement ratio would be used. But there are factors, for instance, adjusting for temporal loss of functions, quality of resource being impacted, and type of mitigation provided that could support a decision to require more compensatory mitigation to offset the project impacts. Now, the mitigation rule is indicating that, in general, mitigation needs to be located in the same watershed as the impact and where it's most likely to offset lost functions and services. The mitigation rule encourages the use of a watershed approach to compensatory mitigation, strategic selection of mitigation projects to address needs within that watershed. And in doing so, we need to take into account watershed scale features, so aquatic habitat diversity, habitat connectivity, hydrologic sources, including availability of water rights, land use trends, and certainly compatibility of the mitigation project with adjacent uses. Mitigation projects can be sited on the public lands or private lands, but credits for mitigation projects on public lands have to be based solely on aquatic resource functions provided by the project over and above those provided by public programs that are already planned or already in place. So I indicated that there were three main types of compensatory mitigation: permittee responsible, banks, and in-lieu fees. Permittee responsible's name is pretty descriptive. The permittee retains the responsibility or the liability for completing the work and ensuring the project's success. That means the permittee or his or her agent is responsible for all aspects of the proposal. Banks and in-lieu fee programs can generally be grouped into something that are called third-party mitigation. Basically, the permittee is acquiring compensation from the sponsor of a bank or an in-lieu fee, and the sponsor is assuming responsibility for the success of the compensatory mitigation. Operation of a bank or an in-lieu fee is governed by an instrument, an agreement between the sponsor, the Corps of Engineers, and typically other associated federal or state agencies. Could be State Water Quality Agency, Environmental Protection Agency, Fish and Wildlife Service, State Game Agency. There are important differences between these two types of third-party mitigation, mitigation banks and in-lieu fees. Mitigation banks are set up in advance of permitted impacts. Credits are tied to performance. Credits are only released when the bank demonstrates that it is achieving project milestones. This makes banking probably the most reliable form of compensatory mitigation. Credits are only released based on meeting performance standards. Now, most of these mitigation banks are sponsored by entrepreneurs. And as of the end of September, there were over 1,200 operational mitigation bank sites around the country and nearly 300 pending bank sites. In-lieu fee programs are a little bit different. The permittee provides funds to an in-lieu fee program sponsor. The sponsor conducts the compensatory mitigation when it has collected sufficient funds. So the projects are not generally initiated in advance of impacts. On the other hand, in-lieu fee programs are given a great deal of scrutiny. There are a number of requirements I'm not going to go into that promote the transparency. Sites are selected through the use of a watershed approach, and in-lieu fee programs can only be sponsored by government agencies, or nonprofit conservation organizations. As of September, there were 32 approved in-lieu fee programs around the country. The number right now is 33, and it's expected to be 34 within the next week or two. What you're seeing here is a screenshot from RIBITS, the Regulatory In-Lieu Fee and Bank Information Tracking System, and it's depicting the geographic locations of bank and in-lieu fee program sites that are operational, essentially within the limits, the geographic limits of the Tamarisk Coalition. This perhaps is a little bit an incomplete view. It looks as though many areas may be underserved. Before moving forward with the development of a bank and in-lieu fee program, I strongly recommend contacting districts to get a better sense of the types of compensatory mitigation that are needed in those geographic areas and the demands. This map is basically showing the geographic boundaries for the various core districts. So for folks within the Tamarisk Coalition, you're basically looking at four core districts, Omaha, Albuquerque, Sacramento, and Los Angeles. And all of them have field offices within the boundaries of the geographic boundaries of the coalition. Development of banks or in-lieu fee programs follow the same development process. It's essentially a four-step process. The first, the draft prospectus, is optional but strongly recommended. The other three are required. The table over on the right, the graphic on the right, is basically depicting the timeline for processing. This information is detailed in our regs and also information on RIBITS. There are specific requirements for prospectus, draft instrument, and final instrument. Basically, the mitigation rule specifies a preference for types of compensatory mitigation. Mitigation bank credits, provided they are the appropriate resource type and the appropriate number, are generally preferred over other forms of compensatory mitigation, followed by in-lieu fee program credits, then permitting responsible mitigation, which is utilizing a watershed approach. In other words, sites are being selected strategically. And last in the preference would be permitting responsible mitigation that is on-site or in-kind and off-site or out-of-kind. The rationale behind this preference is in part reduction of risk and uncertainty, as well as reduction of temporal losses. Banks tend to involve larger, more ecologically valuable parcels than many permitting responsible mitigation projects, and credits are generated based on meeting performance milestones. So risk is clearly reduced or managed. In-lieu fee programs have mechanisms in place to reduce risk as well. There's a limited number of credits that are available before the program has to implement projects. And there's a greater degree of oversight than perhaps other forms of compensatory mitigation, and projects have to be selected utilizing a watershed approach tool, and the interagency group that oversees operations has the responsibility to approve or reject projects. Preservation can be a very important form of compensatory mitigation. Our regs acknowledge that, indicating in general preservation should be done in conjunction with restoration, enhancement, or establishment of aquatic resources. But preservation as a sole form of compensatory mitigation is acceptable provided it's consistent with a watershed approach, a landscape approach to compensatory mitigation. In other words, we're talking high-quality resources that are providing important functions and contributing to the overall sustainability of functions within that watershed. It has to be practicable. These sites have to be permanently protected, and for them to be authorized as compensatory mitigation, they have to be under a clear threat of destruction or adverse modification. Other programs can use compensatory mitigation that is used for offsetting 404 impacts. We see this regularly where state, tribal, or local regulatory programs are also approving the use of the same compensation for the same project. Our rules make it very clear, though, there can be no double dipping. In other words, the same credit can't be used to offset impacts for two or more projects. And these credits can be used to offset impacts under the Endangered Species Act. We see this most commonly in California, in Oregon, and now moving into Washington, where a bank can provide offsets to impacts to listed species, aquatic resources, or both if they occur on the same project. Federally funded projects, Wetland Reserve Program, CREP, Fish and Wildlife Services partners cannot generate compensatory mitigation. Now, compensatory mitigation can be undertaken in conjunction with those voluntary federally funded conservation actions, but must be supplemental to. Again, I had indicated that one of the focuses of the mitigation rule was to ensure that all forms of compensatory mitigation were held to equivalent standards. And one of the ways that this is done is through the mitigation plan. Every mitigation plan has to have or address these 12 elements, whether it's a bank, an in-lieu fee project, or permittee responsible mitigation. So I'm going to go through some of these elements. They may seem pretty straightforward. They are required. So every mitigation project has to be provided some form of long-term protection. The mechanism may very well, in some cases, vary from state or project. And again, this is an important reason to coordinate with your local CORE office. Every mitigation project has to have a plan of work, a detailed description of the work that's going to be conducted, including project boundaries, construction methods, how plants are going to be established, what the sources of water are, how invasives will be dealt with, and so on. Basically, performance standards are how we evaluate whether the project is attaining its objectives and providing the desired function or the desired resource condition. They have to be are typically attributes that are objective, verifiable, and can be measured with a reasonable amount of effort. This means we're often using indicators, and it's important that they be enforceable. That is simple, clear, unambiguous, and precise so that the responsible party can be made to comply. In a nutshell, they have to be mechanisms that, if necessary, can be explained in a court of law to a judge who in all likelihood has a degree in political science or sociology, not aquatic resource ecology. Monitoring is how we determine whether a project is meeting its performance standards. Mitigation projects have to be monitored. The mitigation plan includes these elements on the right-hand side of the picture, and monitoring is for a minimum of 5 years, can be for longer periods of time for resources that develop slowly, or if the site isn't achieving its performance standards, monitoring can be extended. Conversely, monitoring can be reduced for sites that are clearly meeting their performance standards. Financial assurances have to be addressed. Our regs indicate that we're to require sufficient financial assurances to ensure that we are confident the project will be successfully completed. In other words, meet its performance standards. Financial assurances are a source of resources to fix a project in the event that the responsible party is either unable or unwilling to do so. All mitigation projects have to be managed. Frankly, I can think of no projects that I've encountered that didn't require some degree of management. You may be looking at a maintenance plan. That maintenance plan may very well deal with competition control, prescribed burning, or perhaps management of existing structures like fencing and gates. Additionally, each mitigation project needs to address long-term management. That long-term management plan has to identify the parties that are responsible for management, what managerial tasks are required, what the costs are associated with those activities, and how that management is going to be funded. Every mitigation project also needs an adaptive management plan, a mechanism for dealing with unforeseen circumstances. And adaptive management can take place at any point in the course of project implementation. The image on the right is a soil profile that was exposed during a stream rehabilitation project. That dark gray matrix is acid sulfate soils. Upon exposure to the atmosphere, oxygen, and water vapor, it begins to leach sulfuric acid, which has dire consequences for the receiving waters, for the aquatic invertebrates and the fish associated with those waters. So obviously, upon encountering something of that nature, some action has to be taken to adapt. The image below that is a wetland restoration immediately after restoration in the Dismal Swamp. They did an excellent job of restoration, eliminated hydrologic modifications in several hundred acres of prior converted cropland, so much so that they backed water up into an adjoining residential development. They had to adapt. They put in perimeter ditches to deal with the situation. And that's all I've got. I understand we're going to hold questions until the end.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. That was a really succinct overview of a complex program, so I think that was great. Again, all of these presentations and the recording of this event will be made available on our website. So if there are slides or information that you want to reference after this call, those will be made available to you. All righty. So let's keep going here. Our next presenter is Dr. Rebecca Kisslinger, and I'm going to pull up her slide here. Rebecca is a science and policy analyst at the Environmental Law Institute, where she directs the wetlands program. She conducts research and analysis of local, state, and federal wetlands law and policy, including wetland mitigation policy. Recent projects of hers include assessing opportunities for directing compensatory mitigation dollars towards the protection of critical wildlife habitat, assessing the ecological success of compensatory mitigation, and directing the development of study methodology for a national analysis of compensatory mitigation. Rebecca's going to talk to us about some of the last slides that Stephen covered in terms of the long-term implications of management and funding associated with mitigation banking. And Rebecca, if you would unmute yourself. Are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes. Great. Take it away.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Kristen, for inviting me. I'm really happy to be participating today. And actually, my slides flow very nicely from Steve's slides, so this is a perfect transition. As Kristen mentioned, I am going to be focusing today on long-term management and financing of mitigation sites. So the long-term management is everything that, as Steve mentioned, everything that happens after the active phase of mitigation. So after all the performance standards have been met for the mitigation sites and the agencies have signed off on that site. So remembering that these sites, these mitigation sites, must be managed and protected in perpetuity, which is a very long time. So this is a really critical piece of the mitigation pie. So all of the long-term management requirements, as Steve mentioned, should be included in the long-term management plan. And that is the plan that outlines how the compensatory mitigation project will be managed after performance standards are met to ensure the long-term sustainability of the resource. So the plans ensure that the restoration or other mitigation activities that are happening on the site provide those desired functions after the active phase of mitigation is over, and it can involve management, maintenance, and monitoring obligations. So the basic information about long-term management can be found in that primary project instrument. So for permittee responsible mitigation, you might see the party or parties responsible for long-term management in that permit. And for in-lieu fee and bank instruments, those should clearly indicate the party or parties responsible for the long-term management of the site. Then the plan itself is a component of the mitigation plan, as Steve described. So that mitigation plan for a permittee responsible site is either part of the special conditions of the permit or is referenced in those special conditions and then provided as an attachment. Then for mitigation bank sites, the mitigation plan is one component of the banking instrument. And for in-lieu fee sites, there needs to be a separate mitigation plan and, as a result, a separate long-term management plan for each individual site developed by the program. So just as an example, this is a mitigation banking instrument from Texas. They indicate in the table of contents that the long-term management plan is Exhibit H, and that Exhibit H long-term management plan is attached to the banking instrument. Okay, so what's in the long-term management plan? So the 2008 rule requires that the parties responsible for long-term management and maintenance be identified. And then really the heart of it is the long-term management and maintenance requirements or activities. The party responsible for long-term ownership should be identified. And then a description of the annual cost for carrying out long-term management activities, as well as the funding mechanism that's going to be used to meet these costs. So there's some additional requirements for banks and in-lieu fee programs. So then legal mechanisms and the party responsible for long-term management and protection of the site needs to be identified in those instruments. And the banking and in-lieu fee programs must also address the financial arrangements and timing of any necessary transfer of any funds, long-term management funds, to the entity that's going to be providing the long-term management. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the different roles in a minute. So beyond those five requirements in the rule, the regulations don't have any other really detailed information on long-term management plans themselves. So it actually leaves a lot of discretion to the drafter of the long-term management plan. But there are several core districts that have templates or that provide some more specific information on the development of long-term management plans that have been updated since the 2008 rule went into effect. So ELI reviewed all of these plans and guidance documents a few years ago and came up with a number of these nine sections of long-term management plans that seem to be common to the model long-term management plans or the actual plans themselves. Some of these different items are fairly straightforward, but some of them require actually some thorough analysis and thoughtful design, and I'm going to go through these each of these briefly. So the first one is the introduction to and purpose of the plan. So this is where you would see the basic framework of your long-term management plan. It would describe all of the compensatory mitigation requirements for the site. It outlines specific project details, the contents of the plan, and the general obligations. It will identify the parties involved, and it may include some legal language, as in this example, that stipulates that the site must be managed in perpetuity and that the plan is a binding and enforceable instrument, which is a critical piece. So then the party responsible for long-term management and party responsible for site ownership is also included in this section of the long-term management plan. This information is also included, as I mentioned, in the permit or instrument. But sometimes when that permit or instrument and the long-term management plan is in the permit is approved or the instrument is approved and the long-term management plan is initially drafted, the long-term manager may not yet have been identified. So the permit or instrument may have some provisions that allow the transfer of responsibilities when the long-term management phase begins. And the Corps will have to approve this arrangement. And then in terms of site ownership, as Steve mentioned, the rules require that sites be provided with long-term protection through some real estate instrument or other available mechanism. So either through a conservation easement that is held by agencies or conservation organizations or private land managers, or a transfer of title to these entities, or through restricted covenants. So the long-term management plan here should clearly identify the party responsible for long-term ownership, and that may be the mitigation provider, or it may be a long-term manager or a separate entity. It may also include details relating to fee title ownership, and it may also specify who the easement holder will be if that's applicable. So then the next section is the property description and the baseline. So this is where you'll see some legal and qualitative description of the site. So you may see location, history, land uses on adjacent parcels, any property encumbrances. You may see information on property taxes or mineral rights or local water management controls, or if there are any buildings or roads or archaeological sites on the property. And it will also include a physical description of the site, so hydrology, topography, soil composition. Often, though, the long-term management plan is approved before the mitigation activities begin, which can really make the baseline documentation tricky. So baseline documentation can be taken when that instrument or permit is approved and the long-term management plan is drafted. And in this way, the baseline should then include information on what the mitigation work will be, what's going to be carried out on the site, and any maintenance activities that are included in the mitigation plan. And then the baseline can be updated once the mitigation work is complete and the project enters the long-term management phase. So the next section is a description of the habitat and species on the site. So this can include ecosystem types, geographic features, vegetation, native species, any endangered or threatened species on the site. It may include a species inventory or maps, and should include on-site elements that are added or enhanced as part of any of the mitigation activities. Then here's really the heart of the plan. The management and monitoring requirements requires a set of goals. Maybe they're biological or infrastructure or administrative. And then crafting individual tasks in order to achieve these goals. It will include the monitoring tasks. And all of these management tasks can be varied and include population assessment surveys, species mapping, vegetation management, any ongoing restoration work that needs to be done, maintenance of fences or trash collection, damage repair, submission of annual reports, and annual site visits, among others. This could be a really long list depending on the site. And here, I just wanted to point out a bit of tension about the level of specificity that can be included in a long-term management plan in terms of these requirements. So on the one hand, the more specific the plan is in terms of the management requirements, the more accurate the cost assessment can be. So if you really lay out in detail what each management task is going to be, the easier it will be to calculate what costs you're going to need to accomplish those tasks. It's also then less likely that the long-term manager will be called upon to accomplish a task that's not included in the long-term management plan. On the other hand, we all know that sites change over time. Perpetuity is a very long time, and other forces such as climate change may change site conditions such that some of the management tasks may no longer be relevant in the future, or others may be required to preserve the conservation value of the site. So here's, I think, the plan drafters need to weigh some of these trade-offs when developing this part of the management plan. So the next section of the plan is some administrative matters such as transfer, replacement, amendment, and notice. So here's where if there's going to need to be a transfer of management responsibilities, this is where that language would go, or a replacement of a land manager if that turns out to be necessary, and any amendments of the plans that need to occur due to changes in the mitigation site, as well as any notices of who's going to receive this information if changes need to occur. Another critical part of the long-term management plan is this funding and task prioritization. So this section would describe the expected costs, how much money you're actually going to need to accomplish all of the long-term site management activities. and then linking these expected costs to each of those tasks that are laid out in that management and maintenance activities section. So sometimes in some plans, the drafters included a table that lists all the management tasks and then the expected costs for each of those tasks. And it will include some of the underlying assumptions, like what the inflation rate may be, what the administrative costs might be. And I'm going to go into that in just a little bit of detail at the end of the talk. This section will also include the funding mechanism. As Steve mentioned, the funding mechanism needs to be identified in the long-term management plan. Although the rule does not require that a long-term fund manager, so whoever is holding these funds, be identified, or how funds will be transferred to a long-term manager. And this section can also outline the procedures for task prioritization in case any funding proves insufficient to fully implement what's required in the plan. So the example I have here on this slide comes from a California long-term management plan template, and it describes a process for task prioritization. So it states that the tasks that must be accomplished first in case there's not enough money to accomplish everything are those required by local, state, or federal agencies. And then the next set of tasks are those necessary to maintain or remediate habitat quality. And then finally, any of those associated with monitoring resources, particularly if past monitoring has not shown downward trends. Some core districts will want considerable oversight over how these decisions are made in terms of task prioritization, and others may not. In this California example, all of the prioritization decisions have to be approved by the IRT or the group of agencies overseeing the mitigation site. So, and then finally, there's a kind of catch-all section that we called other. This may include more detailed information on a long-term manager. It may include an explanation of any broader biological principles informing the management goals, local, state, and federal laws that may impact management on the site, any natural hazards that may affect the site, especially in light of climate change, equipment or supplies that may be needed for management, possibilities for expanding the protected area. Are there other protected areas nearby that may be linked to this site? Other programmatic objectives, like if there's going to be public education or research on the site, and the impact of the relationship of other compatible uses like hunting may be included in this, among others. So as I alluded to a number of times, the long-term management of mitigation sites can include, and often does, more than one party. So for example, the mitigation provider, the IMLU fee sponsor, or the mitigation bank sponsor may retain the fee title ownership of the sites. And then carry out long-term management and maintenance obligations, and also hold the long-term management fund. And then a separate entity may, like a land trust, may then hold the easement on the site and carry out easement monitoring and defense. Or as a mitigation provider, you might just hold fee title to the site and engage another entity to hold the fund and do the long-term management activities, and then yet another entity to hold the easement. So for each of these sites, you'll need an understanding of all of these different roles. So I'm going to change gears just so slightly, and I'm going to talk just a little bit in more detail about some of the long-term management financing, and then I'm going to point you to some resources that I think will provide a lot more information on these topics. First, I just wanted to point out the difference between financial assurances and long-term financing. And as Steve mentioned, financial assurances are required for each mitigation site, and they're geared toward providing short-term security. So they're actually the funds that are required to make sure that the mitigation site actually is meeting its performance standards so that the mitigation is happening, is being accomplished on the ground. The long-term management funds, on the other hand, are required for everything after the active phase of mitigation, so to ensure that the long-term management of the mitigation site continues in perpetuity. So some of the funding mechanisms that are allowable under the rule in terms of the long-term management include non-wasting endowments, trusts, contractual agreements with future responsible parties, and other appropriate financial instruments. And the key goal of all of these long-term funding mechanisms should be to ensure that the funds that are that are established for each of these sites are legally restricted to the purposes and property for which they were extracted, and they're consistent with all applicable law, regulation, and permitting documents, and that the mechanism is based on legal, financial, and operational principles that provide a really strong statistical chance that they'll persist indefinitely and provide enough funding for long-term management into the future. So how do you determine how much money you're going to actually need for the long-term management of a site? It's a really critical piece of this long-term management plan. So the first three steps listed here, create the long-term management plan, and then break that plan down into specific annual tasks, and then assign an itemized cost to each task, or sort of different parts of this property analysis. And then once you have those, you can translate what you need for each year's long-term management tasks into the upfront funding you'll need over time. So the property analysis tasks involve identifying each of those specific annual tasks, which include many of these stewardship tasks and some I mentioned before, so acquisition, site construction, public services, reporting, field equipment, operations, and they will vary by mitigation site. And then assigning each of these different tasks a cost. So how much is it going to cost for annual reporting or for annual habitat maintenance? And there are several calculators that have been developed that can help with assigning these task costs. And the accuracy of this developing tasks and assigning them of each a cost is really critical to the accuracy of how much money you're going to need in the stewardship fund or the management fund. So then how do you calculate that endowment? How do you calculate how much you're going to need for upfront costs? So what you would do is you would divide how much you need annually, how much the management is going to cost year, your annual cash need, by a capitalization rate, and that will give you your initial amount. So the capitalization rate, or the cap rate, is the projected rate of return, so how much you're expected to earn each year on your investment of your endowment fund, minus the projected rate of inflation, so how much inflation is going to be per year, and minus your administrative costs. So, for example, if you think on your management fund you're going to earn 6.5% a year on average, and you think the expected inflation rate is going to be about 4%, and your expected administrative costs will be about 1%, then your capitalization rate would be 1.5%. So to determine your endowment fund, if you have a property that requires, for example, $20,000 a year in management funds, so that $20,000 would cover all of the management costs for that 1 year, and you have a capitalization rate of 1.5%, then your calculation would be $20,000 divided by that 1.5%, and you would get a stewardship or a management fund of just over $1.3 million. So that's how much you would need up front in order to fund your management costs in perpetuity. It's a lot of money. And so there's some trade-offs here. So on the one hand, applying this lower type of capitalization rate increases the statistical likelihood that you'll have enough money to pay for your stewardship costs year over year. But if you apply a higher capitalization rate, so say you think you're going to earn more on your investments each year, or that inflation will be lower, or your administrative costs will be lower, so you can use a higher capitalization rate, that would decrease the amount of money that you need per year. And that's something that's often advocated by the payers of these funds. So mitigation sponsors may advocate for a lower amount upfront needed. We do suggest that long-term managers are very careful in this calculation, and that they should make sure that they have enough money to accomplish the tasks that they need to accomplish year over year. So I just wanted to end with a few comments on managing the risks in terms of long-term management of mitigation sites. So the first thing is to really carefully calculate the cost you're going to need on an annual basis and the endowment amount or the long-term funding amount you're going to need. Then to develop an investment policy that will really include what the bounds are, your bounds, what you're comfortable with, and what you're going to invest in stocks or bonds or cash, and to work with an investment advisor on these. Then develop a distribution policy, so how the money is going to be distributed to the long-term manager from the fund holder. Draft some accounting and auditing purposes. So develop a policy for how funds are going to be, if you're going to hold all of the long-term management funds in one pot for investment purposes. But we think it's critical that all accounting and tracking for each of these mitigation sites is done separately for each property. And then finally, as Steve mentioned, it's important to include adaptive management, including in the long-term management plan, in case there's some unforeseen events or you don't have enough money in a given year to cover what the tasks. So that was kind of a really quick overview of a lot of these complex topics. So I wanted to direct you to a few sites for more information. We have more information on all of this on our wetland program site, cli.org/program_areas/wetlands.cfm. We also recently completed the handbook for land trusts on long-term management of mitigation sites. And it's specifically written for long-term managers, but there's a lot of really great information in that handbook for providers as well. And then we are also in the middle of a webinar series that really dives into a lot of detail on the different topics associated with in-lieu fee mitigation. And I highly encourage you to look at that webinar series if you're interested in developing an in-lieu fee program. There's a lot more information on determining long-term financing mechanisms. We had a really great webinar on that with three great presentations. And on our webinar, you can find the archived presentations as well as the archived webinars themselves you can listen to, and some other resources. So I encourage you to go to that site if you're interested. And I guess we'll take questions at the end.
Great. Thank you, Rebecca. As you mentioned, that was a lot of really great information, complex subject. And I personally have wandered around the Environmental Law Institute's website, and the resources that they have there are really user-friendly and valuable. So I do encourage those of you who are interested in learning more to use that resource. Great. Well, in the meantime, we are going to have our next presenter, Diane Frisby, speak about a firsthand perspective of being an in-lieu fee sponsor. Diane is a stream project manager with the Nature Conservancy in Virginia. Her environmental work experience includes positions in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors, including working as an educator, consultant, inspector, and project manager. Her research and professional pursuits have focused on watershed and water quality protection management, and she's going to give us some insight into a really dynamic project that's happening in Virginia on a statewide level. Diane, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Thank you for joining us, and feel free to get started.
All right. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to be here today to talk with you all about the Virginia Aquatic Resources Trust Fund, which, as you just heard, is an in-lieu fee program on the East Coast in Virginia. And I'm also going to highlight one of our recently completed projects on Meadow Creek in the city of Charlottesville, Virginia. So you did hear quite a bit about in-lieu fees earlier from Steve primarily, so I won't go into a whole lot about that other than to just give you a few specifics on our program. We are administered in partnership with the Corps of Engineers, our State Department of Environmental Quality, and the Nature Conservancy are the three partners in this program. We were established back in 1995, and our agreement was amended twice, 2003 and 2011, most recently to bring everybody and our agreement up to speed following the 2008 mitigation rule. The main goal of the program is to consolidate funds from multiple projects that may have smaller impacts to really pull those resources and complete larger projects that have a greater chance of ecological success. And TNC is responsible for using those funds that are paid into the trust fund to identify and implement projects upon approval from the Corps and the DEQ, among other members of our interagency review team. And we conduct all kinds of different projects involving restoration, enhancement, preservation of wetlands and streams throughout the state. Let me see. So one of the really important components of our program, which you also heard about earlier, is that as an NLUFI and as a nature conservancy, we are able to use the mitigation funds that come in and target those funds towards mitigation projects in priority areas that we've identified through a watershed and other conservation planning framework. So this map shows you the state of Virginia, and all the blue lines are priority streams and rivers that we've identified through a rigorous scientific analysis. The green areas are all the priority terrestrial conservation areas. So when we do receive payments that come into a basin, we then look at our priority areas and try to identify projects to mitigate for those impacts and use those funds that are in line with priority locations, really to hopefully provide much more of an emphasis on protecting rare plants, animals, important natural communities throughout our state. So in a nutshell, how does the trust fund work? Well, you did hear a little bit about this earlier. The Corps determines the fees that are to be paid for impacts associated with a permitted action. Applicants then pay those fees into the trust fund, basically, you know, send us a check. The funds are held by the Nature Conservancy in an interest-bearing account, and we are responsible for tracking those funds. You know, where, what basins are the funds coming into, how are those funds being used, what projects are we doing, how much money is being used, how many credits are being generated by each project. We submit that information to our partner agencies, and we also develop an annual report that describes all the different projects and the status and activities of our program. In addition to the tracking and reporting element, we also are responsible for using those funds to identify projects and go through the process Steve described of presenting proposals for approval. Everything goes out on a public notice. And once we have completed the public notice period and gotten our approval, we develop that final mitigation plan or the details and specifics of what we're going to be doing on the site. And once that's all approved and finalized, we then manage all aspects of implementation of the project. That ranges from the early stages of protecting the properties with conservation easements through, you know, identifying contractors and overseeing construction activities, and then into the success monitoring period to ensure our projects meet the performance standards, and then beyond in the long-term management after that initial performance standards are met. So to give you just kind of a brief overview of the sort of scope of our program, since the program's inception in 1995, we have accrued about $58 million worth of mitigation payments throughout the state. Those are associated with impacts to non-tidal and tidal wetlands as well as streams. And of that $58 million, we have had $42 million allocated on about 121 projects. So that just gives you sort of a sense of the scope of our program and how much funding and how many projects we actually are looking at. We also do what we can to try to leverage the funds that come in to accomplish, you know, even greater mitigation than what's required. This table gives you a sense of that. The middle column is the mitigation liability or credits that have, you know, that we are responsible for mitigating for that are associated with payments to the fund. And so for non-tidal wetlands, for example, my whole screen just went away. I'll have to sign back on. I'm not sure what happened. I think my computer is actually shutting down. Hold on just a moment, folks. I'm sorry about that. I don't know, Rebecca, if you have any. I mean, Kristen, if you have any advice.
Your computer shutting down?
It looks like it is. So I think I can just re-log in. If everybody will just bear with me here, it may take a moment.
Yeah, that's not a problem. In the meantime,
automatic restart.
In the meantime, we can maybe I could ask a couple questions of Rebecca about, let's see, I guess I had one What I'm not sure about.
I'm actually back up, Kristen.
Okay.
You feel free to proceed with your question if you want, or I can keep going.
No, I'll wait till the end if you're ready to go. Are you back on?
I am. Yep. Sorry about that, everybody. I'm not quite sure why that happens. Friday afternoon, everything's ready to shut down. Describing how we have been able to leverage the funds and the impacts to accomplish, you know, much greater mitigation than really what has come in. So for non-tidal wetlands, as an example, we've been able to more than double the amount of credits that we're producing compared to what we're liable for based on the impact. So almost, 1,000 credits will be produced through projects that we've either completed or have proposed, and 450 credits were required to meet our liability. Does everybody see the map? Is it live?
Yes.
Okay, great. So this is a map of the state of Virginia and all the major river basins, and the point of this is just to show you our projects and give you a sense of how many we have and where they're located. We have over 120 projects in all of the major river basins throughout Virginia. And as we've described and discussed, we do receive payments for impacts in each of these basins, and then we identify projects in the same basin as the impacts, ideally located in areas that are priorities for us to really accomplish the best ecological and most meaningful restoration or preservation, as the case may be. And so now I just wanted to walk you through a little bit of information about one of our recently completed projects, the Meadow Creek Project. It's a stream restoration that was just wrapped up earlier this year. It's actually the largest stream restoration project we've completed to date since, you know, we began this kind of work, and one of the bigger ones in Virginia. So it's definitely a highlight that we've been sharing with a lot of people and hope you find it interesting. So I talked a little bit about how we identify projects and try to target those two priority areas, specifically how this worked for Meadow Creek, to give you a sense of how this actually works on an individual basis. The map on the left shows you the Middle James River Basin in yellow. We had a mitigation need in that basin. Impacts were made and fees were paid into the trust fund to mitigate for those impacts. And so we were responsible for then using those funds and finding projects to implement to mitigate those. So the red circle here is a portion of the Middle James that is a high priority area for us. And again, the yellow map does show you all the blue are the priority streams, the green are the priority terrestrial areas. So in that red circle, we have a priority watershed, the Rivanna watershed. And we were looking, once we had these impacts paid into this Middle James Basin, looking for projects primarily in that Rivanna watershed to try to find a great project that matched up with our priorities. So the map on the right you can see is the green watershed boundary. Meadow Creek is a major tributary of the Rivanna, so that was an obvious place that really meshed well with our priorities. We also had quite a bit of watershed planning information for this area, and as you heard earlier, that's a key component of an in-lieu fee program. The Nature Conservancy, since the Rivanna watershed is a priority area for us, we had developed a conservation area plan in which really identified the major sources of stress on this freshwater system and then the major strategies to really address those stresses. That's kind of the key to that, is what's hurting the system, what can we do to help fix the harm. The city of Charlottesville, where the project is located, had also done some assessments of the streams on their own, and another locality right next door had also done some analysis. So Meadow Creek was identified in all of these plans as an area in need of work, with sedimentation being the major problem that's affecting the health of that system, and stream bank restoration being a major strategy that could help us abate that threat. Soon after those plans were done, the Meadow Creek and some other tributaries in the Rivanna were listed as impaired for benthic life, and that's believed to be because of the excess amounts of sediment in these streams related to stream bank erosion. And a TMDL implementation plan has been developed for sediment to try to help address that. So it's really, there's quite a framework that helped us to identify the project and the need for the project, and also guide us in developing appropriate strategies to try to help improve things. I'll just show you a few not-so-pretty pictures of the site before restoration. You can clearly see here the excess amounts of sediment in the stream bed, the steep eroding raw banks, lack of a healthy buffer, all, fairly typical in what you might see in an urban stream like this, but all things that definitely can exacerbate water quality problems and habitat problems. Here's another picture that shows you, a little bit more of the sediment issue. You almost can't even see the channel in that picture, but it is there. And again, the lack of a good buffer. We also had lots of trash and debris jams and a variety of things going on that were making this a not-so-healthy place. And those trees that did exist were undermined in many cases, falling into the channel, were invasive in a lot of cases or otherwise diseased. And so there was an issue of forest health or buffer health in addition to stream health. The whole corridor really needed to be addressed. So this is a map that shows the entire project area. One of the other things that made this a very viable and an exciting project for us was that it is a big project. Compared to others that we've done to date, it's the longest. So we were able to restore almost 9,000 feet of stream. And you can see on this map, the light blue line is the stream before restoration. The dark blue pattern is after restoration. Everything in yellow is the land that was permanently protected with conservation easements along the stream. There are also 12 acres of wetlands that are within the area. So a long system, 70 plus acres of buffer, and you can also see on this map quite a bit of development in the vicinity of the project. So to have this amount of stream and this amount of land to be able to preserve and to improve right in a city was quite a unique opportunity for us. We also had a fabulous partner in the city of Charlottesville, our local government, that, really without them wouldn't have been able to do the project. They were with us the whole way. We first identified the project back in 2006 and, just now finished construction 7 years later. So it took a lot of perseverance from everybody. But they lots of different departments of the city and experts were very much supportive and helped us out along the way, which really made it a wonderful experience. The other fabulous thing about the city was that they are actually the main landowner. So that was a key component of the project that made it doable was that, those 70 plus acres of land, almost all of that is owned by one landowner that's the city government that we have a great relationship with. So that made it very, very much more easy to get this work done. So I'm going to show you just a series of maps to kind of give you a sense of the land piece of this and how it all came together, because the 6 years or 7 years that it took to do this project came in large part due to the land protection effort that we had to go through. So when we first approached the city, first identified this project, the city owned two pieces of land, shown here in yellow, of about 40 acres. We were initially proposing to just restore the portion on the right hand in this map, but really the upstream portion of this stream, as you can see on the left, was very, very much in need of work. And so the city owned a piece of upland there, but not the stream, so we couldn't really do a whole lot. So we wanted to try to include some land in that area, and we ended up approaching a number of different private landowners who ended up donating land to the city or selling land to the city to enable the project to happen. So the next few slides just give you a sense of how we pieced it all together. We had a couple of different land donations in 2009, going on through a couple of additional properties were donated in 2011. And the last piece of the puzzle that kind of connected everything was a conservation easement that was donated by a private landowner in 2012. So, about 6 years worth of effort to get it all, pull it together, but as a result, we ended up with a really great big project, and the city is now the owner of all of this property, except for the four-acre piece in the middle. And through that, we were able to add 30 acres of new parkland to the city's park system, which is kind of an ancillary benefit, but one that is very important, I think, for the residents and for protection of this corridor. Another thing that I think was exciting to us about this project was that we did have the opportunity to conduct some or provide some additional benefits beyond the mitigation. So there are research opportunities, educational opportunities, recreation, as I just described, that really make this a special project that you don't get in your rural, you know, isolated one landowner kind of a project. So we've done lots of tours of the site. We're going to be putting in a self-guided interpretive trail system with signage. We've got a number of different graduate students that are studying the project and have engaged volunteers for trash cleanups and the like. So it's really been a really great opportunity to involve the public and get some research, good research done. So you've heard a little bit about, you know, why we selected the project and what our goals were. I wanted to talk a little bit about the design goal specifics and show you then some pretty pictures of what we did. But all of our projects employ natural channel design for stream restoration. And the main goal, as I mentioned before, was to tackle that sedimentation problem. We also wanted and needed to address stream stability and improve that. A lot of banks are unstable and falling in and trees falling in and the like. In areas where we have a decent, or at least a treed buffer, there are also tons and tons of invasives and dead and diseased and dying trees. So we wanted to improve the health of the existing buffer, and in many areas we had no buffer, so we wanted to establish buffer. We also had, you know, lots of piles of sediment in the channel, which don't provide great habitat, so we wanted to address that by helping bring in varied habitat elements to improve diversity and provide a good place to live. And, again, permanently protecting this whole corridor, the wetlands and the buffer. So how do we accomplish all that? Well, the most critical piece to accomplishing, you know, reduction in sedimentation and improving the stability of the banks was to reconnect the stream to the floodplain. As you can see on the picture on the left, we had a number of areas of very steep, vertical, totally unstable banks. And that's actually me standing in the creek before restoration, and that bank collapsed into the creek before we actually were able to start our project. So it was very, very unstable, and lots of sediment, you can imagine, was being deposited when those kinds of collapses would occur. The picture on the bottom right shows after we you know, sloped back the banks, enabled the channel to actually access the floodplain and dissipate energy versus being trapped in the channel and just continuing to exacerbate the erosion problems we were seeing. Another key feature was channel relocation. So we, in essence, ended up abandoning many portions of the old channel because the pattern was really, really unstable. We had areas where the meanders were extremely tight. We had other areas where the channel had been straightened historically to, you know, enlarge space for agriculture and other reasons. And so we ended up creating a new channel next to the old channel that had an appropriate and stable meandering pattern. And you can see the picture on the left is the new channel being created. On the right is an aerial shot of the restored stream. We also installed about 100 structures in the channel, including root wads, veins, grade control features, bank toe protection, all of which were designed to help improve habitat and help improve bank stability and prevent stream bed scour. And a big piece of improving habitat in the area was to, you know, help transition from lots of unconsolidated sediment to a healthy, stable habitat features like riffles and pools. So you can see the picture on the left is a construction of a riffle, and on the right you can see some examples of that after the work was done. I did mention that invasive species were present on the site, and they still are. This is actually a list of all of the species that were identified early on as a part of our inventory before we started the work. So this is a key piece, again, to try to improve the health of that buffer along the stream. And this will be something that we will be working on far into the future, since there's so many different types. And the being in an urban area with trails throughout, they're just, you know, kind of constantly coming in. And it will be quite an undertaking to keep on top of them. But we're working on it. Also, as a part of the buffer improvement, we did extensive stream bank and buffer plantings. So all told, at the end of the day, we planted about 19,000 trees and shrubs in this area, all native, you know, common to the region. We also planted 50,000 plugs, small herbaceous plants, all throughout this corridor. And, of course, extensive amounts of floodplain seed mix were also spread throughout. So the idea is that all those new native plants will help us transition to a healthy, forested, diverse buffer. The last slide I have for you was just a brief overview of some of the challenges, which I also consider opportunities in many cases. I mentioned that this was a project in an urban area. We oftentimes do projects in more rural areas where we are working on, you know, a farm that had cows in the stream and no buffer. This was a unique opportunity to work in an urban setting and do a significant project, but with it comes challenges. Infrastructure being a significant one. We had gas lines, water lines, power lines, any kind of line you can think of pretty much going through this area that we had to work around. And so that drives up your cost, but also you do have to sometimes make design decisions based on that. So we were able to still do a great design, even with all the pieces of infrastructure in place, but that is something that kind of adds a little bit of an extra effort on our behalf. Invasive species management I've covered already with you. That will be something, though, that is a bigger problem here than at many of our other sites, just due to the urban nature of the area. And working in a public park, again, has its pros and cons. We did have to close portions of the park during construction, and some folks weren't too happy about that. And a couple instances, we had people ignoring our signs. We had mothers pushing baby strollers and cross-country teams running right next to our track hose. So it was a little bit of a challenge in sometimes to make sure that safety was, was first, and that we made sure that everybody was aware of what we were doing and stayed away. But that was just an extra hurdle. We had, as you can imagine, lots and lots of stakeholders from, the city departments to our private landowners, neighbors, utility owners. So that was, another level of coordination that we don't always have on our projects. And the outreach that was done to the public in the neighborhood also was extensive. We had numerous public meetings. We received comments through review of the design from the community. And during construction, we posted updates on Facebook and on the city's website to keep people up to speed on what we were doing and what was coming the next week. And in addition, for the city to be able to place those conservation easements on the properties, we did have a process of public hearings and city council votes to be able to do that. So that was, again, something you don't get with your single landowner you might be working with on an easement. The citizen education piece I touched on, lots of that, lots of getting everyone up to speed on what we were doing and the benefits. In some instances, we did have concerns that we tried to address, the main one being people concerned about the loss of trees, because some trees did have to come down to do the work. But for the most part, we had a lot of support, and everything went really well. And then lastly, definitely great that the project can be used as a demonstration site, but, almost weekly getting requests for tours and other things to show the project, which is great to be able to teach people about it, but it's just another thing to be, prepared for in embarking on a project such as this, the extra time and effort to do that work. So I will leave you with before and after of the creek and my contact info, as well as our the Trust Fund's website here at the bottom, and happy to take questions afterwards.
Great. Thank you so much, Diane. That was a wealth of information and I think a really good case study of working with multiple partnerships, and I hope we have some folks with good questions. All right. Our final presentation is going to be given by Stephen Collins. Stephen is with the Wetlands Bank Group, and his responsibilities include the overall operation of the company, including the development and implementation of the company's business plan. Stephen also serves as the director of the National Mitigation Banking Association. He has been active in the mitigation conservation banking industry since 1996. So Stephen's going to talk to us a little bit about this program from the perspective of a mitigation bank as opposed to an in-lieu fee sponsor, and I'm going to talk about some of the challenges and successes of mitigation banking. Stephen, are you there? Stephen, if you need to unmute, you can press *6 if that's how you muted yourself initially on your phone. Hello? The music playing. Forgive me. Hello? I'm not sure what's happening.
Hello?
Hello? Is that
Hello? This is me. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay. Sorry about that.
That's all right. I think we got some Muzak playing in the meantime. In any case, can you see the website and see your presentation?
Yeah, everything's fine on this end.
Okay, great. All right, well, then let's kick it off, and I will move the slides for you.
Okay, great. First of all, I'd like to start off by recognizing Diane and Meadow Creek and TNC for the project that they just demonstrated. As a practitioner who has done stream restoration, that's a tremendous undertaking. You should be very proud of it, which I'm sure you are. I'm here today to talk from the perspective of a practitioner about mitigation banking, and I will be touching on some of the same things that you heard from Steve Martin and others, but again, looking at it from the practitioner perspective. The things I'm going to discuss are the regulatory framework, actually permitting a mitigation bank, and then some key factors when you look at operating a mitigation bank. The one thing to remember throughout this presentation, mitigation banks work because of regulation. We are a regulated industry. We are created by regulation. We survive by regulation. And, you know, if we aren't careful, we can die by regulation. We are not an essential industry. I think of essential industries, things like agriculture. People need to eat. Housing. People need shelter. You know, although I think some of our more forward-thinking people now realize that we need good water, clean water management, and a way to store and filter water, we're still an industry that's managed very much by regulation, so always keep your eye on the regulatory environment. The regulatory environment for mitigation banking has been developing since the late 80s with the first George Bush Declaration of No Net Loss of Wetlands policy, all the way up through the joint mitigation, compensatory mitigation rule that Steve spoke about in great depth that became effective in April of 2008. And listed on this slide is just some of the steps in between. And that's just a picture of the Federal Register when the federal rule finally became active. Some important considerations regarding the rule. It's a rule, not guidance. Everything prior to the rule in 2008 was in the form of guidance, and it was subject to interpretation and adoption by every district of the Corps in the United States. So the Corps, as you would move from district to district, might interpret the guidance differently and may or may not choose to implement all or certain parts of it. So it made for an inconsistent business platform in which to do work. And as you know, to be any industry to be successful has to have a repeatable business method in order to be successful. And prior to the rule, that framework, that infrastructure simply did not exist. The second thing that was important about the rule being put in place is that it now applies, as Steve Martin said, to all forms of mitigation. Whether you're doing on-site mitigation, off-site in-kind, in-lieu fee, or a mitigation bank, you must follow the federal rule. There are 12 fundamental components that Steve went through in great detail. These have always been the fundamental components of a mitigation bank plan, and when you're going through your prospectus stage, you have to address all these and at some level, and then of course in your final mitigation banking instrument, which we'll talk about in a minute, you will address each one of these in great depth. And I would say historically that other forms of mitigation address some or most of these to a lesser extent, but not as completely as they're required to now. So if you think about it today, in order to permit a 5,000-acre mitigation bank, you must meet these 12 steps and provide things like financial assurances, a site protection instrument, and all the components. If you're doing a 5-acre compensatory mitigation site off-site, you must also meet all of these 12 steps, these 12 components. So from a regulatory perspective, it takes about the same amount of time, I would guess. Steve, in the question and answer period, could probably comment on that. So it's pointing towards the efficiency of large sites. In order to permit a mitigation bank, you need two things. One, you need a mitigation banking instrument that I will refer to as an MBI. And you also need, assuming that you're going to be working in waters of the United States, you need a Section 10-404 permit in order to do your actual restoration work. Both of these permits, and I call MBI a permit. An MBI is really a private agreement between the mitigation banker and the signatory agencies to the mitigation banking instrument. As Steve Martin indicated, the signatory agencies to the mitigation banking instrument can vary depending on the location of the bank and the purpose of the bank. In some cases, NOAA, if it's a coastal bank, they may become a signatory to the bank. And in other occasions, Fish and Wildlife Service will be involved. You can feel pretty confident that on every mitigation bank, the Army Corps, the EPA, and the local Department of Environmental Regulation will all be signatories to the mitigation banking instrument. And I would say 8 times out of 10, the Fish and Wildlife Service will also be. But there can be others like Soil Conservation or NOAA, as I've indicated. Both permits are processed through the Interagency Review Team process, which is known as the IRT process. The IRT process has three basic steps. There's an appropriateness determination, a site inspection / scoring step, and then the permit documentation and issuance. An appropriateness determination is accomplished as part of the submission of a prospectus. And the prospectus outlines, you know, who you are as a banker, what your project is, how you plan to restore it, what the benefits are, and how it will be managed in the long term. Once your site is determined to be appropriate by the IRT, and that's not always a guarantee, and having a site being determined to be inappropriate is not always a curse either. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. But once your site is determined to be appropriate, we go out and we score the site. We measure the expected ecologic improvement that's going to occur on the site as a result of the restoration, enhancement, establishment activities you have planned for the site. And then all of that is documented through the federal process with the MBI, which is the credit enabling document, and then the 404 or nationwide permit, which is used to allow us to do our restoration work. A mitigation bank is scored in what's known as the without bank scenario or its current condition, and the with bank scenario, which is an anticipated or forecasted position. And this is a picture of one of our first site that we did in southern Florida. And before, it was kind of a dump. And as you can see afterwards, it was restored into a freshwater marsh. As part of the process, we go out and do what's called scoring a site. And I tend to skip over this when I'm talking about mitigation banking, but I find that afterwards, this is among the questions I'm most frequently asked, so I've decided to insert a slide here to talk about today. When we do restoration, when we create mitigation banks, the currency, the product that we get to sell are called credits. And people say, okay, what's a credit? How do you make it? The way a credit is made is that you go out and you score the site using a functional assessment methodology approved by the local core district to assess the ecologic condition of the site. How is it functioning today and without a bank? And in my theoretical example, I said it's functioning at 75% of normal or perfect. Then we walk through with the IRT our restoration plan. And it is agreed to that likely the score after we complete our restoration will be 0.85 or 85% of normal. So I am going to be effectuating a 10% improvement or lift over the site. You simply then take the lift that's created times the number of acres over which that lift is going to occur, and that gives you the number of credits that you will earn over time. Oops. Now, getting these potential credits is one thing. When you actually receive them is quite another. As part of documenting your project in the mitigation banking instrument, you will get a credit release schedule. And credits, the 10 credits I showed you in that theoretical example, are released over time based on one of two activities, either completing a milestone activity or showing a trending towards success. So, you know, early on in the process, you will get a certain number of credits for putting the protective instrument on the site, placing the financial assurances, and doing the restoration. In a typical mitigation bank, of which there are none, by the way, there is no typical footprint. They're all quite different. You will get less than 50% of your total potential credits for placing the financial assurances, placing the protective instrument, and doing all the restoration. And so the other half of your credits rides totally on your success. You know, and if the site is not successful, you will not get your credits. And that's just a fact of life in our business. So you want to be very aware of it. That just changed on me. There, okay. Going on to the next slide, I want to talk about some of the key permitting clauses in the mitigation banking instrument or the mitigation banking process. We want to talk about the service area, the time lag and risk calculations, and then some ideas regarding credit sales. The service area, when you're looking to serve a service area, they usually start looking at the HUC or the hydrologic unit code that the site is located in. But some of the parameters they evaluate are the benefit to the regional ecologic network, does it provide long-term viability for T&E species, and is there a reasonable expectation of offsetting wetland impacts within the service area? If I am building a cypress forest in the middle of the state of Florida, which is predominantly a sawgrass marsh, there is not a reasonable expectation I will be offsetting the wetland impacts that are going to occur within my service area. And so that will be a factor that is considered as my bank is permitted. Something else to note, you know, getting a service area, this is not like getting a public utility franchise where no one else can come into your area. Service areas are non-exclusive. So, you know, one of the problems about establishing a successful mitigation bank is that you attract all your competitors and all your industry colleagues, and they come in and now all of a sudden you're competitors. The other thing to note is that there can be exceptions to using the service area. A couple of exceptions that come to mind are what are known as linear projects. A linear project can be a roadway, a pipeline, and the concept behind a linear project is that it will pass through a service area, it will impact a portion of a wetland, but typically does not remove the entire wetland from the landscape. So in the case of a linear project, if you have a linear project where the impacts occur partly in your service area and partly outside of your service area, you can be allowed on a case-by-case basis to offset the entire impact at your mitigation bank. But again, it's not guaranteed. All impacts are approved one at a time. A service area does not guarantee that you will get to offset every impact that occurs in your area. Time lag and risk. In my simple calculation that I showed earlier, where you have functional gain going from 0.75 to 0.85, so 10% improvement, and then times the number of acres, 100 acres gives you 10 credits. After you get that, what we call the raw credit score, those credits are adjusted with two factors. And the first factor is time lag. And time lag is simply the amount of time it's going to take between when the actual functional site of the impact site is, you know, when the gain is actually enjoyed at the mitigation site as compared to the impact site. So a great case for this are forested wetlands. You know, forested wetlands take time to grow, and you need to adjust the amount of credits you're being awarded by the amount of time it's going to take to grow into a fully forested wetland, which is what you are replacing when you accept impacts at your mitigation bank. The second factor is risk, and that's the uncertainty that mitigation activities will reach their projected levels. And it's just the risk of failure, things that you can't control. From our perspective as a company, the way we manage risk is that we spend a lot of time studying the pre-existing conditions, the historical conditions of the sites. And, you know, we look to return sites to as much of their historical condition as possible. In other words, you know, we're not interested in taking interstates and making wetlands out of them. We're looking at areas that were historically wetlands, where hydric soils are still present, where there's still some indication of hydrology, and it just improving the existing condition. Because risk factors that will be used to adjust your credit score are typically pretty heavy. So we looked for natural sites. Credit sales. As Steve Martin alluded to, when we are selling credits, the impacts that we are offsetting have to be like-kind mitigation. As you saw in his presentation, there is the potential opportunity to offset not like-kind impacts with mitigation credits, but they're very few and far between. So as part of your diligence process establishing your bank, it's important that you have a very clear understanding of, you know, what type of wetlands or other functions, biologic functions, are eligible or in the threat of path of development, under threat of development, that might need impacts. And building a site that is easy to do, if it's not compatible with what's happening in the environment, is going to be a financial disaster. Something that should work on our side, some data recently developed by the National Mitigation Banking Association that's worth sharing. Going back to the 12 components of a mitigation plan and the fact that every permit, every impact permit has to have that 12 steps if they're using on-site or off-site. What this graph demonstrates to you very simply, that if you are applying for a 404 permit to build a project of whatever kind, and you're planning on doing PRM, permittee responsible mitigation, on-site or off-site, it's going to take you a lot longer to get that permit than it will if you use a mitigation bank. So as a potential banker entering the industry, it's important that you know this. That, you know, and you know, these aren't numbers that we made up. These are numbers that have come out of the federal databases that track the 404 process. So an important piece of information. Having said that, as you can see, this is across the United States for the year, I believe it was 2012, mitigation actions by type. When someone was forced to mitigate, they used either a bank or a in-lieu fee program about a third of the time, but yet probably two-thirds of the majority of the time, they're still doing permittee responsible mitigation. Now, you know, this chart can be misleading. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily predisposed to doing permittee responsible mitigation. There are many areas in the United States where there are neither an in-lieu fee or a mitigation bank option, and permittee responsible is the only option. But again, as part of your diligence, if you're looking at getting into this business, this is one of the things that you should be studying. You know, in the area, what is the predisposition? Is there a predisposition towards banks? Is there a predisposition towards permittee responsible mitigation? You know, what's the regulatory environment in which I'm going to be working in? A couple of things about operations. Three key concepts. You know, one, understand your location. Two, understand your restoration plan. And three, as I alluded to just a second ago, understand the regulatory climate. First, location. When you pick a location, you need to strike a balance whereby you are close enough to the area of impact where it will be considered to be a likely and meaningful offset. You know, picking a remote site to offset urban impacts doesn't always work. And here's an example. This is a real-life example of one of the projects that I worked on. The site is the very small, irregular-shaped piece, magenta-colored piece in the bottom right-hand corner of the map. As you can see, it is bounded to the west by Everglades National Park, to the south and east by Pennycamp National Park. And it really kind of was the connector piece that brought these two national treasures together. So from a locational perspective, the initial impression was this is an ideal site for a mitigation bank. And when it was being permitted, it was viewed as such. When it came time to sell credits, the same regulators who permitted the bank came back and said, well, you know, it's a swell site, but it's out in the middle of nowhere, and it's really not close to anything, and it's really not going to be replacing the values and functions in a meaningful geospatial perspective relative to the impact site. So, again, you know, don't be blinded by the beauty of your site and its perfect location, its perfect perspective. Your perspective has to be balanced. You want to be close to development, but not too close to development. Your restoration plan, you know, as I mentioned, you in most cases, you receive 50% of your credits or less after you have completed the placement of financial assurances, the protective instrument, real estate protective instrument on the property, and all the restoration. The rest are based on ecologic success. And if you aren't successful, you don't get the credits. Any banker will tell you that the financial profile of a mitigation bank is the profits in mitigation banks come in the last one or two credit releases. You know, they are back-end loaded projects just like most real estate projects. The money you make up front, you are either recovering your initial investment in the form of the land you purchased or the land rights you purchased, the restoration you've undertaken, your soft costs, your permitting costs, and then your intermittent credit releases are usually fairly small, and they're usually used to maintain the site and to recover the rest of your costs. And then finally, the last credit release is when you demonstrate ultimate success. That's when you actually make money on these projects. So if your project is unsuccessful, you know, if you're not enjoying ecologic success, you're not going to make money on these projects. It's important when you, and I can't stress this enough, when you get your restoration plan together, and it's typically put together by an environmental consultant, don't be afraid to have the plan peer reviewed. Even go as far as seeing if you can get a core person to look at it. You know, the core people, at least in the area of the Southeast U.S. where I work, are very experienced and looking at, you know, these restoration plans and being able to give you a good idea. If your consultant's saying, you know what, this is a 1,000-acre project, and I'm going to get you 900 credits, you know, 90% lift, and it sounds good, and it's your way to financial success, and it's your retirement plan and everything else, but if it's unrealistic, it's a pathway to disaster. So having it peer reviewed is critical, and you know, an afternoon with a core person, and what Steve Martin referred to as a pre-prospectus meeting, can be very valuable when, you know, and they're usually pretty good at saying, well, you know, this may happen, but you would certainly be the first that's ever done this. Or here are the concerns I would have if I was building this project. So they can be very helpful. And again, if you're not successful, you don't get the credits. And remember that you have to maintain these projects in perpetuity, has been stressed many times. The other thing to remember is there is no walking away in these projects. As a mitigation banker, you bond the construction cost, you bond the perpetual maintenance cost, and you fund the perpetual maintenance cost. And I have seen situations, and I have been involved in situations where, you know, we've completed a bank, we've turned it over to a long-term steward, the long-term steward did not meet up to expectations, and the mitigation banker has been brought back in to fix it. That's me. So, you know, these projects, you want to make sure you understand your restoration plan thoroughly, the risks, the signs of failure, and so you can protect yourself moving forward. Finally, the regulatory climate. As I mentioned at the beginning of the business, you know, this is an industry that was created by regulation. They affect how we create our unit of production credits through the permitting process and the credit release process. They affect our operations by measuring our success and our maintenance, and they affect our sales because they issue the permits. So if someone creates, if someone regulates all three phases of your business, they regulate your ultimate success. You must be ever vigilant of the regulatory climate. The regulatory climate in the United States for wetland mitigation banking over the last 5 years has improved dramatically. But that's not to say that, you know, things won't change. There are a lot of influencers on that, and you must be ever vigilant of the regulatory environment. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Great. Thank you, Stephen. We are at 1:55, and we slated 2 hours for this webinar, so we have only a few minutes left. I know, Stephen Collins, you are on a short timeline here. I guess one question that I would have for you as we're waiting for any of our participants to figure out if they have questions, which they can ask by pressing star one on their phone, and then we'll ask them in the order that they are posed. My question is kind of about that location component. Is there a way that groups that are considering becoming mitigation banks can determine the level of permitting activity in their area so as to assess whether this is a viable option for them?
Well, yeah, there are. You know, some of them are a little more costly and complex than others. And I'm not doing a shameless promoting, but the National Mitigation Banking Association, of which I am a member, we track the core permits issued every year. And I believe in any given year there's probably 50,000 permit decisions made across the U.S. We have all those in a geospatial database, whereby you can go in and you can, you know, you can look at an area and find all the different types of impact permits that were issued, and you can actually go in and, you know, get the permit number and look at the mitigation required and stuff like that. So that's one way to do it. There are many consultants who have the ability to generate those types of maps. You know, so it's an important part of your diligence process to figure out, you know, where the impacts are occurring.
Okay, great. So I actually didn't know that. Because when I've tried to assess that, it's been really exclusively through Army Corps of Engineer records of past activity. So that's actually super helpful. Let's see if there's any questions from our audience. Nothing yet. A question that I had for Rebecca was on the point of the long-term funding and wondering if ILFs or mitigation banks could take out loans or have some kind of bridge funding in place as a component of determining or illustrating that they had that the amount that they needed to cover the project costs in perpetuity, and then pay back that loan with the monies that they were able to generate through the credit sales. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. But I think that for the in lieu fee programs, the long-term management funds wouldn't be due until the long-term management phase began. So you
okay.
would have that money in hand at that point from the credit sales, and same for banks.
Okay, so you don't have to have that funding secured before you start the project.
Correct. And Steve can
We do. This is Diane. We do for our program set those funds aside before our project is officially, you know, approved to begin construction, versus waiting until the you know, long-term management period begins.
Okay.
And just as from an administrative perspective, I would tell you, Kristen, that these type of projects are generally not bankable, because the product that we are producing is a credit, is something of an intangible. And when you take your local lender out there and you show them a degraded farm field that you're going to turn into a wonderful wetland or a T&E species site, and they kind of grimace and they go, well, if you don't make your payments, can I turn this into a Walmart? And you go, no, because I'm placing a conservation easement on it. it has a real chilling effect on the loan package.
Yes, that makes sense.
They all make very good questions. There are multiple ways to fund that long-term management obligations. As Diane indicated, in the case of TNC in lieu fee projects, they're funding long-term management obligations as part of the overall project cost, and that's one way to do it. Another way to do it would be to work out a schedule of payments. We see some situations where long-term management funding obligations are funded through credit sales. One of the most effective mechanisms we've seen so far has been when they've been tied to release of credits. In other words, credits would be released not only upon meeting performance standards, but also upon funding a portion of your long-term management obligations as a way both of ensuring that development of the principal takes place, but also ensuring that it can begin to generate earnings. And those earnings are an important part for funding your long-term management activities.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm not seeing any questions from our audience members. If there are questions and you're having a hard time figuring out how to ask them through our audio system, you can ask them through the chat box as well. We are at 2 o'clock, so if we don't get any questions here in a second, then I'll conclude our webinar here. I guess I just wanted to ask one more question about, and this is kind of to anyone who has a response, but a lot of the groups that are on this call and that the Tamarisk Coalition is working with are existing restoration efforts. And I wonder if there's an easy way for groups that are already doing restoration to plug into this system, if there's a demonstrated, audience or market for the credits. And I ask that kind of in thinking about some of the baseline assessments. If there's a certain amount of restoration that's already been done, it's probably a challenge to determine the fully degraded conditions of that watershed. So I don't know. I wonder if any of the presenters have a response to that and how you would think through that process from the perspective of someone who's doing restoration currently.
Well, I think you're going to have two problems or two challenges. The first is getting acceptance of your baseline documentation, assuming you have it. If you don't have it, then you've got an insurmountable challenge. And then the second challenge is going to be making sure you can pass what Steve Martin referred to as the double dipping test. You know, if some form of funding or especially if it's public funding, had already been provided in order to, you know, get you started in this restoration process, then chances are you're going to have to either refund or somehow decouple or fragment the work between, you know, what the previous funding has taken care of versus what future funding as a mitigation bank may create, you know, environmental benefit.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's really interesting. So public funding could qualify that project for being considered as double dipping. It looks like we do have a question from one of our participants. So I'm going to unmute that person. Hello?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, thank you all for your time and the information. My name is Rusty Lloyd. I work for the Tamarisk Coalition here in Grand Junction, Colorado. I guess my question is do you guys see a growing trend with compensatory mitigation in one respect or another? And I guess what I'm asking is, do you see any future things that you guys are keeping your eyes on? Increased regulation, decreased regulation, or is kind of is it just going to be driven by impacts versus development? But my question is, do you guys see any things that are emerging here in the near future with this program?
Well, absolutely. We're seeing a growth in the scale of third-party compensatory mitigation banks and in lieu fees. something that we're starting to see spread. Initially, most of the stream mitigation, the stream restoration, was taking place in the mid-Atlantic through the southeast into the Midwest and down through Texas, and we're definitely seeing it spread now. It's moving further west as a form of compensatory mitigation. We're also seeing a lot more restoration and conservation activities that are oriented at providing offsets for impacts to listed species, and often what we call joint banking, banking that entails restoration of aquatic habitats that are also home to listed or at-risk species. There's an In Lieu Fee program operating in Arizona on the Colorado that provides offsets for core permits to the Colorado River, and the compensation is focused on activities that contribute to the recovery of listed species in the Colorado, the razorback sucker and the bony-tailed chub. I think we're going to see more synergistic efforts of that nature as time goes on.
And I would agree with what Steve said. Yeah, I refer to those as ecosystem service sites. I can tell you in the state of Florida, you know, in the wetland mitigation banking world, you know, the ideal site is, you know, 995 acres of jurisdictional wetlands and 5 acres of upland, so you have a place to park your car. But the actually building a site that's just purely wetlands is getting harder and harder to do. And after having been in the business for a while now, you know, you realize that the better solution is a holistic site that serves both, you know, wetland and upland needs. And so I wasn't aware that the Arizona project had gotten underway, but that's exactly what we're looking for on a go-forward basis, is one that will serve all needs, a site.
Great, good question. All right, well, I think we can wrap it up from here. And I thank everyone for participating past the slated 2 o'clock time frame. Thank you to our presenters. You all did a great job of making this very complex program more digestible. And again, we will have a recording of this event and the copy of all of the presentations up on our website soon here. And you can feel free to contact me with any questions that you might have. And we ask that you fill out the evaluation survey if you have time. I provided the link in the chat box. And any final thoughts? No. Okay.
Thanks, Kristen. I appreciate it.
Thank you all. Much appreciated. Have a great weekend, everyone. And we'll hopefully talk to you all at our next webinar. Thanks again.
Great.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thank you.